This is John Buckman, Branch Chief of the Indiana Firefighter Training System, and we're here to do our first audio cast. And we're going to do it on training tonight with two significant individuals who've influenced the fire service. Chief Alan Brunicini, retired from the City of Phoenix Fire Department after 47 years, and Billy Goldfeder, Deputy Chief of the Loveland Sims Fire Department. So, Chief Brunicini, I'll start off with a question for you about training. And how do you think the training of firefighters today is different than in the past?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a lot of subjects that we didn't have before. For example, in the Ice Age, when I became a firefighter, we did mostly firefighting tactics, hydraulics, and it was very... The training was centered around fire control. Now, if you sort of look at that change in almost 50 years, there's hazmat, there's EMS, there's special operations, there's public education. In other words, there's a lot more competition for subject matter time. So I think that the subjects are certainly a lot more robust if you look at them across sort of the training agenda. But I think a lot of folks have started to see that it has distracted and maybe detracted from some of the classic firefighting tactics kinds of things that we looked at, again, when I was a kid in the service.
Yeah, that distraction, I think, is an interesting topic. I know Billy has some positions on it. We're here at the Near Miss Conference in San Diego, California, where we're conducting this interview. And so, Billy, what do you think about the distractions and training?
Well, I don't know if it's – I mean, distractions is one word, but I'm kind of excited about the future. A lot of people in our business are not all these new kids. What do they know? A bunch of maggots, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't see it at all like that. This is probably the smartest generation of firefighters we've ever seen. They're more into information. They have instant access to information. The way they communicate is a whole lot different than we used to. Some of that's positive, some of that's a negative. The negative is what worries me is you may, let's say you're an instructor at rookie school, and if you go up to a firefighter and you give him an order, and he tells you to text it to him instead of talking to me. So I think we're losing a little communication skills there. On the other hand, our ability to get information to these kids, this is the biggest group of sponges we've ever had. They're so thirsty for information, and I'm very excited. So as far as distractions, I would turn that into a positive, but what that means is we've got to come up with additional ways of training. I still believe in hands-on. I still believe they need to learn to pull hose, they need to climb buildings, they need to raise ladders, all that. But there are so many more ways we can deliver that additional training to enhance and supplement their ability to survive. And that's really all we're talking about, is to send them home to their mom or their wives or their husbands or boyfriends or whatever they have at the end of the day. So the key, again, falls into the instructor's ability. It's not that these new kids are goofy or weird or screwed up. We just have to, again, adjust for a new generation. This is the gamer generation, and there are some cool ways to help these kids train. But remember, I guess in the old days, if Chief Bruno was assigned to a station and he'd ask a question, they'd say, shut up and just do as you're told. In your day, John, your firefighters would ask a question, and you'd say why, and they'd tell you why. In this generation, they'll come to me and say, what do you think, Chief? I'll say this, and then they'll get on their iPod or their iPhone or their BlackBerry and verify that on the Internet. So it's a third dimension. I think it's great.
Chief Brunicini, you have seen a significant amount of change in the fire service in your years. You've been at the forefront of many of that change. You have pushed this fire service forward in a positive way in which many firefighters are alive today because of your command training program. What do you think are some of the changes that you've seen in command?
Well, I think probably the biggest one, if you looked at it as a national initiative, is the NIMS process. In other words, that NIMS I think mobilized the large scale federal level of incident operational management, maybe in a way that only the wildland fire community had done before. I think, though, that when you look at the five types of overhead teams that they have identified, the threes, twos, and ones are the national-level teams, but they say very clearly that the fives and the fours are local and area-level command teams that are really left up to the locals. In other words, that there's a lot of individual customization of the procedures that we use, the way we deploy. In other words, that there's a lot of just local variations. I think that in that way, that on the local level, the command really has not changed that much in the last 35 or 40 years. I think if you look at the original form that we developed, sort of basic management functions on the fire ground that we use every day, single-family residences, small commercials, routine EMS events, and so on, that certainly those hook up to and enhance NIMS, but I think those have been really kind of timeless in the process. And I think that particularly for the work that we're doing here at this near-miss thing, is that firefighters get injured and, sadly, more seriously, things happen to them, line-of-duty deaths, mostly at local events. So I think one of the things that we see pretty clearly is that if we are not using a command system every day in our own communities that fit the needs of that community, that we can escalate up into larger operations, what we're doing is we're leaving out probably 99% of the activity where our firefighters are exposed. So I think that sort of today the scale is a lot bigger. So I think as managers we've got to sort of figure out how do we fit that scale into what we're doing and understanding the whole range of it too.
Well, I think you bring up an interesting point because I think that's one of the things that from the smallest to the largest fire department, if you don't practice it every day, you're going to fail.
That's right.
When you need it will fail you because you're not used to doing it.
Particularly people like firefighters who are action-oriented people who solve their problem by actually doing manual labor. If they can't somehow connect to that every day, they get separated from it. I guess you could say they lose interest in it, honestly.
Let me take that to a step before or after, and I'm not sure where it fits in yet. I'm not able to conceptualize where this fits in this discussion, but I know it fits. If you're going to shoot down King Kong and you only have a small gun, you better hit him either in the private parts or hit him in the eyeball to knock him down. In other words, you got to have the most impact with the weapon you have. In tying into what we're talking about, fire departments, fire chiefs, and communities must realize it takes this to do that. So if I'm staffing my organization for a single-family dwelling, and I can do the 15 to 18, 20 tasks that I need to, and I do 15 to 18 people on a small 1,000-square-foot single-family dwelling, when I respond to Jones's department store on Main Street, I am unable to do any more than what I could do at that single-family dwelling, or do one thing, such as I can flow a deck gun. But mayor, all I have is this many people. Commissioner, I can only do this much. And that link is the responsibility of the fire chief, the locals, and even in volunteer fire departments, volunteer associations, to get the community leaders and the community members to understand our fire department's really good at this, we're fair at this, and we're miserable if this happens. And we can do better at being miserable in that area if you'll provide us with this. Now, with that, we have to consider automatic mutual aid. We have to consider working with our neighbors. Chief, you said a couple years ago the smartest thing of the many almost smart things you've said and the many very smart things you've said. You said that mutual aid ought to be a law. You got to call the closest fire department. That would solve so many problems.
It shouldn't be mutual, but it ought to be automatic.
Automatic.
That's right.
You can't pick Joe's department and skip Mary's and Sue's. And that will force us to work together and operate together, things like that. But back to the issue of the staffing, which is one of my favorite things, so I try and move into that whenever given the opportunity. When we're going to operate at a fire and we know we've got 8, 10, or 12 people on duty, we need to be as best we can, which ties into what we're talking about today, John, is training. In training, if we're an 8-person fire department, we should be the best people at flowing deck guns in the United States. Man, we probably can't go in. I mean, unless the baby's in the window, we may throw a ladder there. Okay, but if it's well involved or just heavy smoke, I don't have the people to get in. But can we do the best possible with the staffing we're given, with the resources we're given? If you got a 1968 pumper, we have the responsibility to make it the best 68 pumper possible. Because otherwise, when you go to the table and ask for more stuff, they have the right to ask you, what are you doing with the stuff you have now? So I wanted to slide the staffing thing. Go ahead.
Let me tag on to what Billy just said, and I've been pondering this. I never worked in fire prevention. I studied the code when I went to fire school, but I honestly, am looking back on it, I wished I had. But we need to connect the local fire code more and more to firefighting tactics. Because what the code creates is the framework of what where we have to operate tactically. And what Billy just said is that I can do a single-family room and contents fire, and I got 16, 17 firefighters in the first 8 or 9 minutes. When I look at the rest of that community, that the rest of that community is going to burn down based on the code. So if they have large, undivided, heavily fire-loaded, unprotected buildings, yeah. and all I can deliver is a single-family residence room and contents.
I'm going with a pistol to a shotgun.
But to
right.
say, and to say, there isn't anything wrong with that, nobody is doing anything inappropriate, but I don't think we've done a very good job of saying that that fire code creates the tactical framework of the kinds of situations that we're going to inherit when they're burning. And we ought to go to the body politic and say, you got fires this big, and we got a fire department this big.
And here's your option. Here's your options. Menu. Pick here's off my menu.
Absolutely. Right.
It's an interesting concept that the federal government has actually been asking states and local governments to do since September 11th, and that is to determine your capability. And the capability relates to the size of the problem, the number of people you have to throw at the problem, the equipment, the apparatus, et cetera, et cetera. And the fire service just says, well, we'll just throw more people at it and more apparatus, and they don't understand the capability. It's measuring the capability of a local fire department.
And that's to say, can we assemble the concentration of force to deal with that window, that tactical window, as that fire progresses? And if we can't assemble the force, two cops don't go into a barricade. They wait for the SWAT team. But what do?
Well, we send the first, second, third, fourth. We just have
this
obligation.
We were laughing this morning. If we had cannons on the fire trucks, would get in them.
Right.
So they could shoot
us into the building.
Yeah.
Right.
No, and it's nuts, too.
And when you sit and dissect this, it takes away the romance of firefighting. Oh. And that's the word. I mean, it really is right. From that book in the early 1900s, that romance of firefighting. It is a romance. And we do love it. And it's like a football player on the sidelines. Send me a coach. I'm ready to play. I want to go in. We want to go in. And we, chiefs, lieutenants, captains, whoever, have to manage that. Because, I mean, our firefighters would go run and jump naked in a dumpster just because they said they've never done that before and want to see what it's about. But we have an obligation as the coaches on the sideline to determine who's going in based upon the risk. What's the team? What's the other team like? How are we doing on, you know, all that sort of, I mean, the analogy of football and firefighting is pretty cool. You look at the start at the training, you look at the players, you look at the positions. No one's on the field without any gear on. You've got the interior command officers, you've got exterior, you've got sector officers. I got a boatload of people on the bench in case they're needed, but everyone on the field understands their role, their responsibility. I mean, it's kind of cool.
Well, Billy, we would play football with two players
right.
or with 80 on the team,
exactly.
on the field.
Because you won't win the Super Bowl with two players.
That's right.
But no one's
with 80 either, John. Yeah.
True. I mean, nobody's blowing the whistle.
That's right. Right.
We need these guys in striped shirts.
That's right. No,
okay, hold it. You know, where's your helmet?
That's supposed to be a command system. I mean,
well, it's a controversial position to say, you know, you got to have enough people to play the game. It takes 11 people on a football field to play the game at a time, per team.
If you want to play standard football.
Yes, if you want to play professional football.
That's right. Yeah.
If we're a professional fire service, how many people does it take to put on a fire ground of a single family dwelling, 3,000 square feet, to safely, effectively extinguish that fire?
Let's walk through it. Let's assume we're hydranted just so we don't get too complicated. I need one on the hydrant. I need one on the pump panel. If I take the building and apply it to the fire flow guide, it'll tell me what I need, 1,500 GPM, whatever it is. Well, determine the amount of lines you need. What's my involvement? If I'm doing exterior operation, interior. For each interior line, I need three firefighters on it. You know, say, oh, you only need one or two. Well, yeah, then you're going to get one or two worth of effectiveness in stretching that line.
And you're only going to get about 6 feet inside the door.
That's right. I want a force entry. I mean, the idea is to beat the fire when we can without it beating us or getting ourselves killed. I mean, we do want to, and people listening shouldn't interpret this as you or me or any of us saying, let it burn down. We're saying, give us the resources so it doesn't burn down, whether it's the fire code, whether it's sprinklers, and those are resources, or give me enough people to deal with it, and in some cases, I am willing to send them inside to put that fire out. In a lot of cases, I'm not. And more people are understanding that slowly. But I really think people are starting to get it. That, I mean, you're going to go explain to my wife or your kids that they died because of a single-family dwelling, was non-sprinkled, built outside code, and I've got two people on the engine company? Who gives a shit?
I mean, really, there's nothing we can do. Sort of like you were talking about a warehouse fire years ago. Was it yesterday we were talking? Where, what kind of program does your city have for the homeless? Well, we really don't have a program. Well, what has your fire department done for the homeless lately? Well, we don't really do much for the homeless. So then why in the hell are you pulling up to a well-involved warehouse and searching for homeless? Well, there's the romance of firefighting.
It's an alibi.
Well, it's an opportunity to go in and do the job. And we want to do the job. But we've got to strike that balance of simple risk management. Is it worth going inside? And there are some people in our business still tell you today, hell yeah, it's worth going in. Those are the people where your alarm bells should go off when they're saying that.
You know, I was with a group of firefighters the other day, big, heavy-duty Eastern Fire, East Coast Fire Department.
Or San Francisco.
And they had a crew that got burned. And the longer they talked about it, they had six tactical positions. I thought about it when you were going through the routine.
Yep.
They had six tactical positions, and they had five companies. And the sixth position walked around the fifth company and burned them because nobody had covered it.
Right.
So there's a case to say, look at that situation and say, how many basic operating positions do I have? You got a tactical worksheet, and you say, if I got six positions and I got four companies, Chief Tippett better start saying, give me a second alarm.
Immediately.
Immediately.
Or
absolutely.
Even before immediately. Let's tie it into
ahead of immediately,
to the communities where
the
staffing is low, response is slow.
Right.
A volunteer fire department, in most cases during the day, Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. on a Tuesday, is going to have trouble getting out. It's a known. Well, then why don't we have an automatic box alarm system where we're putting four or five companies on the road? I mean, who doesn't want to go to a fire? The others are listening, dying, you know, they're sweating and shit, dying to go to this call anyway. Put them on the road. But if you're going to do that, then you got to train for them. You got to have these common radio frequencies. My hydrant connections have to work. But if we pause this tape and rewind with that rewind noise, it comes back to, can we do it through code? Can we do it through ordinances? Building construction, and unfortunately we know if we sprinkler, we do through code, a lot of the fun goes away.
But all of those are in a fire protection
plan,
food chain.
Yeah.
That's ahead of manual fire suppression.
Right.
When they call us to do manual fire suppression,
everything else should have failed.
Everything failed.
Yes, right.
So what we're doing is we're resorting to the least effective part of that model to do the worst scenario, because it occurred, everything else failed up until then.
So isn't it sort of like you go to the doctor, you got high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and he just sits and waits for you to have the heart attack and then he defibrillates you.
Right.
Instead of treating it beforehand to minimize it, because, I mean, if you're going to be defibrillated, odds are, call a funeral home. But, I mean, that's sort of what we're talking about, just waiting and waiting. Well, just wait. Let's
same
just wait.
Thing.
And boom, now we have a fire and it's a crisis.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What we're up against is fires are few in most communities. So getting the code to change, oh, wait a minute, you know, come on, we only had five fires last year, right? Or getting more staffing. Well, come on, you guys are doing okay with what you have.
But, you know, John, Billy, we're sitting in San Diego, California, doing this interview thing, and they are in the process, after the worst fire seasons they've had in the last four or five years, of changing the code, the residential code. And I'd never heard this reference before. They're calling it ignition-resistant buildings. Not fire-resistant, but ignition-resistant. And they can show places where they've changed this code that had major high-intensity fires, structures didn't burn.
Right.
So there's a case where the code
makes a difference.
A huge difference.
We don't have to kill anybody for woods.
I mean, so that's just a real smart way for them to manage that package.
Well, that ties back to what you're talking about.
We know codes have helped.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the last 20 years, the newer buildings do not burn because of better codes, better construction. It's still the older buildings, in many cases, that are still burning. It's, you know, new buildings have sprinklers. New commercial buildings have sprinkler systems. Some residential structures have sprinkler systems. I mean, it would still be, if we start sprinkling every building today, it'd still be 50 years before we probably had them.
Much longer than that, they say.
So then we go back to the defibrillation issue. We'll wait for the heart attack to happen to defibrillate. Now, prior to that, if we can't change the code, we can't add sprinklers, what we can do is have a sensible response defense force, meaning the fire department, your first alarm assignment, to match the risk.
in neighborhood A, where none of the homes are over 2,000 square feet, we want 25 firefighters. I don't care if they come in 25 fire engines or whatever. Okay, neighborhood B, where our homes are up to 10,000 square feet, the mansions, this is the response we want. Neighborhood C, we have no water supply, so I need 8 to 10 water tenders or tankers on the first alarm assignment. I mean, that's what needs to happen if we want to put the fire out.
And fire chiefs and fire departments must have the confidence in their ability to deliver that to tell the public what their limitations are.
Here's the menu. I mean, it's really one from column A, one from column B. Make a decision. And it's not a threat. It's the fire chief saying, look, we're willing to accept risk to a point, but if we can't fund anymore, if we can't staff anymore, if we can't respond anymore, all I can do, and I'm the best in the business at it, meaning this is the chief speaking, is if that home in neighborhood A catches fire, we are the deck gun masters, and we will deck gun the... So overload your home with smoke detectors, both kinds, so it goes off, get out, and we can put the fire out and stop it from spreading. But I do not have the people, I do not have the staffing, nor do I have the want to risk my people to send them into your house if you're not willing to support me.
Because of every code on this planet, they are written to get the occupants out, not to get the firefighters in.
Right.
Very true.
There's not a firefighting dimension in the fire code.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you know, even many of the codes, there's an allowable amount of fires to occur.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't want to predict what that is, but you know, that, and there are certain things that certain events that will happen in the building where people will die. It's acceptable.
And they die according to code.
Right. They die according to code because the code says.
It sounds awful when you say it, but isn't it?
Well, 30 years ago, we built built nursing homes without sprinkler systems. People can't get out on their own, and we wondered after people died in droves, then we had to go back and retrofit nursing homes.
Yeah, well, we changed it. We acknowledged there's a problem, we changed it. The problem is two sides of it. One, the city or community or politicians, though, don't want to take on the code issue, or the city or the politician or the whoever that doesn't want to take on the staffing issue.
Right.
They'd rather just sit. And it's really like insurance. You can go with the cheapest, absolute bare minimum car insurance, and odds are you will not have a problem. But if you do, you're in trouble. Or you can go with a better insurance company and know that if you'd have a problem, you're going to get a rental car, they're going to take care of it, the car will be fixed within a week, or you can go with the best. We're really talking about, I mean, it reverts right back to the romance of firefighting and insurance marks on the houses and everything else. We're an insurance policy, and we will be able to deal with whatever you throw us. But in the insurance industry, before they want to start paying you money, they have a risk management system. They want your teenage drivers to go through this program. They want you to, you can't have DUIs, we're not going to insure you. That ties into code. That's things we can do beforehand, so we don't have to pay out your payout, whatever the hell it's called, which is the response of the fire department. That's the final thing the insurance company wants to do is write a check. The final thing we should have to do is respond to the failure, which is a fire.
A good friend of ours, Ken Burris, who is the chief operating officer for the U.S. Fire Administration, once told me or asked me, what kind of fire department are you trying to give the public? The kind they want, the kind you want, or the kind they're willing to pay for? And there are three different answers to that question. Because many fire chiefs are trying to give the public the kind of fire department they think that they should get. Well, the public decides what kind of fire department they get by the amount of money they're willing to pay for it.
And based upon the last time there was a fire.
Sure.
That's a big... I mean, Chief Jarman here in San Diego is smart. Immediately she's jumping on the issues of fire following the fire season. If they went quiet for a couple seasons with no fire, there'd be no code change. There'd be no apparatus changes. Nobody cared. There wouldn't be three separate committees determining the future of San Diego County's fire service, okay? So really, striking while the iron's hot is a big issue. And when you have a problem, it's an opportunity to show what we can do to change that problem so it doesn't happen again.
Well, I know you guys have spent quite a bit of time with me. I certainly appreciate Chief Bernasini and Chief Goldfeder spending some time with the first audio cast for the Indiana Firefighter Training System.
Oh, this will crash the system, then. This will be the last.
I doubt it. But
sure, yeah.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate your time.
See you in Indiana.
All right.
FDIC.
Indianapolis, FDIC.
FDIC, see you there.
Thanks.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
John.